I'm going to start the recording, and the way I'm going to do this is by having it spotlight on me, so that'll be the primary focus for it, because I know some people don't like having their faces on camera. I do prefer, if possible, for people to... Good evening. I do prefer, if possible, for people to have their video on, because it's easier for me. If I'm actually talking to people, as opposed to if I am, talking to a bunch of gray squares. So yeah, that's my personal preference when possible. I'm just trying to figure out, for some reason, I'm not seeing the control anymore for spotlighting video. I used to be able to do that. I'm sure I can still do it. I just don't know why I'm not seeing the option right now. Let's see.
Change the view to view speaker.
Yeah, no, view speaker is one option, but spotlighting actually is stronger than just than that. But I see where it is. Okay, done. Okay. So, without further ado then, I'm going to start recording and we are going to begin because we have an awful lot to talk about. Thank you very much for turning out this evening, but of course, people are at home, so that part of it was easy. But thank you very much for tuning in at any rate. I want to thank Shari Shamayim for their willingness to co-present and usually host the Monday evening legal ethics classes. Understandably, that's not happening right now. However, God willing, in the future, we'll be back at Shari Shamayim again, and I look forward to being there in person. The session this evening is dedicated with the following donations from our Day of Giving that my Beit Midrash held back in July, from Chavi and Paul Jacobs, Miriam Moish Keston, and Brandon Barry Pacus. So, thank you. As I said a few minutes ago while we were just getting underway, if you want to either join the email list for these classes or receive a letter certifying that you were here, please sign in the chat. You can send the message just to me personally if you don't want to put it out there for the world to see. You don't need to enter your email address if you receive the email from me advertising this class. That means I have your email address. Otherwise, though, feel free to send it to me. Certainly, if you've updated your email address, you should please send that to me. All right. In general, during the session, I much prefer if people ask questions out loud, as opposed to writing them in the chat. I prefer not to have to monitor the chat during the session. So, if your sound isn't working, if you have children screaming in the background, then fine, put your message in the chat. Otherwise, I prefer out loud. That works better for me. If you're taking a look at the source sheet, and I am going to once again put the link for it in the chat so that everybody has it, you'll notice, first of all, a note at the top about signing in. Below that, you'll see a note about the professionalism topics that we're covering in this presentation. When you file for approval for CPD credit, they require that you list what exactly you're covering that relates to professionalism. So here we are going to be discussing recognizing and being sensitive to client circumstances, dot, dot, dot. But below that is what I wanted to point out. This is an article I saw a while back. It's probably about 7 or 8 years ago. It's an excellent article, very worth reading, by Professor Steven Reznikoff, called Bankruptcy, a Viable Halachic Option? He's a professor at the DePaul University College of Law, or he was at the time when he wrote the article. And it's really a good read. It's what got me started in this whole topic. So what we're talking about this evening is indeed bankruptcy and the Jewish client in the era of COVID, and specifically issues related to sensitivity to the needs of the client and the demands, in this case, of a client's particular religion. So on the source sheet, you can see the vignettes for our topic. Take a look, please. We have three of them. First of all, my observant Jewish client is badly in debt. I want to advise her of bankruptcy options, but she won't hear of it. She says that her parents, Holocaust survivors, would turn over in their grave to hear of their child failing to pay her obligations. What can I tell her? I think that it's in her best interests. What can I do to convince her that it's appropriate? That's going to be our first question. Second question. My observant Jewish client is filing for bankruptcy, so we got past the initial hesitation. How can I protect him from religious sanctions in his community as well as from being challenged in a rabbinical court? Okay, fear that after he has taken care of filing for bankruptcy, after the proposal has been approved, he may have a creditor who comes after him in rabbinical court or may have people looking at him askance within the Jewish community for having filed for bankruptcy. What can be done about that? What can be done in order to shield the client from those concerns? Is there anything that you can do? And then finally, the COVID case, because the first two have relevance at all times. My observant Jewish client owns a Jewish summer camp and was unable to hold a camp season last summer due to COVID. Her customers are demanding refunds of their deposits, but she spent that money on physical infrastructure and administrative salaries before the pandemic forced the camp to close. Would she be better off addressing this in a secular court or a rabbinical court? There is a preference in Judaism for a rabbinical court. It's a preference of Jewish law, as we will discuss. But the question then is, where would she be better off? In which venue? Those are the three questions that we're going to discuss. I'm going to ask you for comment on them as we reach them one by one. But we're not there yet, because first, we need to know what bankruptcy is in the first place. What exactly are we talking about? So in contemporary law, there is a concept of personal bankruptcy. If you go back in history, you go all the way back to the Code of Hammurabi. They have the possibility of liquidating a person's assets in order to get their debts paid. The Torah has the same concept. However, Hammurabi does not seem to have any sort of discharge of debt. What he does have, on the other hand, is slavery. The idea that you can take somebody who's a debtor, who can't pay, and make him a slave. The Torah does not have bankruptcy discharge. We'll talk about that in a bit. But it also doesn't have debt slavery. There's no concept in the Torah of enslaving somebody or, for that matter, imprisoning somebody if they can't pay their debts. The year 594 before the Common Era, Solon changes Athenian law to allow a debtor to forfeit citizenship in order to have his debts absolved. So there's a possibility of losing your debts. You just have to lose citizenship in the process. Fairly high price for bankruptcy. The year 533, Common Era, the Justinian Code is the first one, at least that I'm aware of, to allow for actually absolving someone of their debts. And in the year 1542, Henry VIII creates the first formal bankruptcy statute. What does bankruptcy look like today in Ontario? So I gave you a link in source number one. You're probably all familiar with this. To the procedure in Ontario. Basically, it's a legal process designed to relieve honest but unfortunate debtors of their unsecured debts. And the way it works is the client presents a proposal offering to pay the creditors a percentage of what is owed over a specific period of time, or to extend the amount of time to pay off the debt, or some combination of that. There are consumer proposals if the individual owes less than $250,000, excluding mortgages, and there are also commercial proposals. A consumer proposal has the debtor disclose all assets and property that's been disposed of in the past few years, surrender credit cards, and assist the trustee who administers the bankruptcy and attend financial counseling. So the creditors look at this proposal. They vote. They either accept it or reject it. And then you have something called the Office of the Superintendent of Bankruptcy, which oversees administration of bankruptcies and proposals under the Bankruptcy and Insolvency Act, a link to which I gave on the sheet in source number one. So once all the terms of the proposal are met, then the debtor is legally released from the debts that were included in the proposal. There's more to be said about priority among creditors. We're not going into that because this is not a class about how one files for bankruptcy. This is about the professionalism aspects that relate to bankruptcy. So I'm going to take the spotlight off of me for a moment here, in order to be able to see you and have a little bit of a conversation here. Why? First of all, let me ask you, Was that a valid description of bankruptcy? You're the lawyers here. I am not one. Does that fit your understanding of how bankruptcy works? I see Paul's giving me a nod. Yes. Zevi also. Alan also. Okay. I'm seeing, you know, general consensus that yes, this is how bankruptcy works. Okay. Step one taken care of. In many ways, the hardest step, given, again, I'm not a lawyer, so I was kind of hoping that that was all accurate. So now I'll ask you a question. Why does society create a bankruptcy option? What's the point?
The world believes in second chances.
The world believes in second chances. We like the idea that a person is going to be able to get a second chance. Does a creditor like that idea?
No.
No, the creditor does not like that idea. But you're just going to say, well, let's go along with it because the world believes in second chances. There's nothing pragmatic about it. It's idealistic.
Yes.
Zevi says, absolutely, it's idealistic. Anybody else?
Well, the creditor has no choice.
Yeah.
Because the guy, you can't get money from a stone, right?
Right. So Schleimi says, this way, I'm going to just modify your words a little bit, but basically what Schleimi is saying there, this way, at least you get the cooperation of the borrower, and you get some repayment. Yeah, the alternative, he says to you, sorry, I can't pay you anything, and he just stonewalls you, and you get nothing. So this way you get something. And I think that's an important piece of it. What else?
For the fair distribution of assets to the creditors.
Meaning?
Instead of everyone fighting amongst each other, it'll be distributed out in some sort of organized, fair-ish manner.
Right. So there's the fact that it's organized, I think, is an important piece of it, an organized distribution. How might a bankruptcy policy or bankruptcy procedure help society as a whole?
There's another element to bankruptcy.
Yeah.
Aside from liquidation, a lot of bankruptcies are more restructuring. Mm-hmm. Like in the U.S., what everyone refers to. I'll stop if you were going to go this.
No, go ahead.
Like a Chapter 11 or here under the CCAA, instead of somebody sort of being financially crippled for the rest of their life and not on a go-forward basis being able to be a productive economic member of society, there's a perception in many cases that it is better to restructure and instead of destroying a business, allow it to recover and move on and keep other people employed who would otherwise lose their jobs, you know, create potential business for suppliers, that a restructuring ultimately will result in more economic benefit than just crippling someone permanently.
Right. Good. You're reducing the burden on society, fundamentally. So that society is not supporting an eternal debtor. Now you're opening up the possibility that this person is going to come back to being, as you said, a productive member of society. It also reduces the incentive for criminal behavior, right? You give somebody an out, so it isn't just, oh no, I have nothing that I'm able to do. It also helps to encourage wise lending. As opposed to, let's say, the mortgage crisis from a while back, you make sure that people are going to lend wisely when they understand that they're not just going to be able to go after him until they finally get their money, but there's a possibility they're going to have to accept some kind of restructuring, some kind of settlement. And then last note on this that I would say, although I see Michael unmuted, maybe he's going to add something to it, but a last note on it is that it encourages entrepreneurship because it provides a safety net. If there's no out, if there's no possibility that somebody is able to get out from under this, people become a lot more cautious. Sometimes it's good for people to be cautious. But this gives people the opportunity to also be able to take a chance and know that if it doesn't work out, they can live to fight another day. Michael, were you going to say something?
I think I'll hold back. I'll keep my powder dry.
Okay, keep the powder dry. Go for it. Okay. So all of these are reasons why society does this. Yes, it is, as Zevi said, a good thing to do in order to help the borrower. Absolutely true. It also helps the lender to get something, and it helps society as a whole. So that's how you end up with this system. Now, what we're going to have to ask is, so then why doesn't Judaism have a bankruptcy option? If it's such a nice thing to do and it helps all these parties, why doesn't Judaism envision a bankruptcy restructuring something? Why isn't that there? So we're going to talk about that. But this is enough groundwork to now be able to approach our first vignette. Yes, Alan, you were going to say? Nope. Okay. So now we can approach our first vignette. So I'm going to read that out again from the source sheet and go back to spotlighting video. Okay. And here again is what we said. My observant Jewish client is badly in debt. I want to advise her of bankruptcy options, but she won't hear of it. She says that her parents, Holocaust survivors, would turn over in their grave to hear of their child failing to pay her obligations. What can I tell her? So I put the question to you. And again, thank you to those who have signed in the chat. For those who came in after I made the announcement, look at the top of the source sheets and you will see a message there about how to sign in. What would you tell your client who says, this is something that I can't ever do. I can't bring myself to file for bankruptcy. What would you say?
Well, you explain to her, presumably she's in really bad shape, and you explain to her, this is really necessary.
Okay.
And that if she doesn't do it, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, that's a nice, practical approach, but we know that people, including clients, are not always practical. Now what do?
Well, you might explain that maybe your parents' time, this was not an option so much.
Mm.
And it was looked at with disdain and with a jaundiced eye, shall we say, whereas today, as you know, if it's a legitimate bankruptcy and this... there's honestly no way, and there are no assets, that there's nothing wrong with it. You
know? Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's, I think it's fair to point out differences over time. I think that, that is, a legitimate distinction. But I think there's a lot more here that we could say. First of all, I think as a first stage, validation is really important. Meaning, recognizing and acknowledging that it's reasonable for the client to consider bankruptcy a religious failure. There are at least three different sources in Judaism for an obligation to pay one's debts. If you take a look on the source sheet, it's source number 2. I brought you one way that it is framed. It's actually a passage in the Talmud in Bava Metzia, but I brought you Rashi's quote of that passage because Rashi explains it very nicely. In which he says, in source number 2, and as is our practice in these classes, I brought you the original Hebrew on the source sheet, but in the interests of time, I'm just going to read the English aloud. One is obligated to pay his debts and fulfill his words. And he quotes you the verse from Leviticus, from Vayikra, in which the Torah says a person has to have what's called a hin tzedek. And maybe I need to explain this a little bit further. The Torah talks about the importance of having honest weights and measures. And so it says, you shall have an honest hin, a hin is a volume measure, and an honest ephah, which is another volume measure. It talks about even shlema v'tzedek, an honest weight. All sorts of measurements are listed there, and the Torah says they have to be honest, but the sages had a problem because some of these are redundant, meaning I wouldn't have to tell you, you have to have, if you were somebody who had a business of measuring out beverages, you own a bar, I wouldn't have to tell you, you shall have an honest liter, and you shall also have an honest pint. Well, those are different measurement systems, I get that. But nonetheless, I wouldn't need to tell you that. Once I tell you, you need to have an honest pouring, you know, that you have to pour using honest measures. I don't need you to list each kind of measure that you have. So the sages looked at that and said, there's more that we're meant to deduce from the list of honest measures. One of those measures is called a hin. And the word hin is very similar to the word hain, which means yes. And so what Rashi quotes you from the Talmud is the statement that when the Torah says you shall have an honest hin measure, it means that when you say hain, when you say yes, it should be honest. So what Rashi is trying to tell you, quoting the Talmud, is that there's an obligation. When you say yes to somebody, you have to keep your word. When you say no to somebody, you have to keep your word. Make your commitments in good faith and keep them. That's the way Rashi reads it. Not only that you have to be sincere when you make the commitment, but as Rashi understands it, also you have to be sincere and go about fulfilling the commitment that you made. So that is one biblical source for the obligation to keep your word, to keep to your commitments. Another source for this is brought in source number 3. Rabbi Yom Tov Elasvili in 13th century Spain also brings this idea. He points out that there's a biblical text which says that in the event that somebody borrows money and he pledges a collateral, so he has to allow them to take the collateral from his property, or I should say he brings out the collateral. So Rabbi Yom Tov Elasvili makes a comment here in source number 3 regarding this, and he says the following. He says, Tosfot, I'm realizing now it's going to be a little harder to understand this. I brought it kind of in the middle of the quote. I'll explain it outside of the text. I should have brought more of the text in order for it to be more clear. His challenge, basically, the first half of source number 3 asks, how can you use the text that we used in source number 2? Source number 2 said, when you say yes, you have to be honest. That was the statement in source number 2. So source number 3 says, that's not really a basis for requiring me to pay my debts. That just means I had to be sincere when I said I was going to pay it. But if something happens later, so be it. I'm not obligated to pay. I was just obligated to be honest when I made the commitment. I meant that I was going to pay. And so the source number 3 says, we have a different source that teaches that you're obligated to pay your debts. It's a verse in Deuteronomy which says that if you borrow money and you promise that you're going to give a collateral, then you have to bring the collateral out of the house. As the verse says, the man from whom you are claiming, you are the creditor, the man from whom you're claiming shall bring the collateral out to you. So the statement here, I'm getting off of the spotlight because I can't see everybody's faces, and that makes it harder for me to make sure that this is clear. The statement that that Rabbi Yom Tov Elasvili is making in source number 3 is that I know that a Jew is obligated to pay her debts, to pay his debts, based on the fact that the Torah says that when the creditor comes to get the collateral, the creditor has to wait, and you, the borrower, take the collateral out of your property and go give it to them. So that teaches there's an imperative to actually provide the collateral. So that's a second source. One source for saying you have to pay your debts is because the Torah says, speak honestly. Second source that we're bringing is because the Torah says you will provide the collateral. And then there's a third source that's brought in source number 4, and it's based on the fact that the Torah says that in the event that somebody steals, they have an obligation to return whatever they stole. So based on that, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra says, well, if you steal something, you have to return it. If you're holding someone else's property because he lent it to you, and then time's up, you also have to return that. Why should that be any different? If I have a duty to return stolen goods, I also have a duty to return borrowed money, borrowed goods. So that's also a source for the obligation to repay. There are other sources we could bring as well, but I hope what we're establishing here is the sages understood, based on biblical verses, each one bringing a unique verse, that there is an obligation to pay one's debts. Clear? So far, so good? Okay. So that's actually relatively straightforward. That's why your client says, I don't want to do it. I don't want to declare bankruptcy. I would be running afoul of all of these biblical verses. Not only that, but Judaism has avenues of complaint against people who do not stick to their commitments. If you take a look at source number 2, anyone familiar with the term Mishapara? Does that ring a bell? Mishapara.
It's embarrassing people in public. It's like an embarrassment.
Nope, that's Motzi Shemra or Malbim Pnei Chaver.
It's a compromise, isn't that what you're...
Nope, that's Pshara. Mi Shapara.
Somebody's having a cow. Oh, no, that's not it.
So. Nope. Cute. Nice try, but no. So Mi Shapara. Sorry? It's close to a punishment for not keeping one's word. Good. It's a curse, is what it is. In the event that somebody enters into a transaction and money has actually changed hands, and then somebody wants to back out, saying, I'll give you back the money, right? Somebody comes to me, I promise to sell him something. He gives me the money. And then I decide I want to back out? I'll give you back your money. So he has the ability to go to court and get them to issue what's called a mi shepara. Mi shepara literally means the one who punished. And if you take a look at source number 5, you see the text. The one who punished the generation of the flood will punish one who does not stand by his word. They issue a curse saying that God should punish people who give their word, engage in a transaction, and then back out midway through. And there's actually more to the text, and there's a lot of discussion about who says this. Is it the rabbinical court saying this? Do they make the person who backed out actually be the one to declare this? That's if funds have actually been put up, if money has changed hands. But even if money has not changed hands, there is still a level of punishment for it. Take a look at source number 6, please, from Rambam, from Maimonides. One who trades only verbally, okay, if the only thing that happened so far was a verbal commitment, should still stand by his word, even though he's received no payment, has not marked the goods, has not given a pledge, and anyone who backs out, whether buyer or seller, even though he need not accept a mishapara, there's no curse because no money changed hands, he is still considered to have acted in bad faith. And ein ruach hachamim nocha hemenu, which means the sages are not pleased with him. There are a couple of ways to translate those words. I'm giving you one way. The sages are not pleased with such a person who backs out. There's more to be said about this. In source number 7, I gave you a link to a longer class of mine about breaking verbal agreements, where I summarize some of the issues. But the point here is this. When your observant Jewish client says to you, I can't file for bankruptcy, my parents, their values would never accept it, the first thing to say is, you're right. It's to validate. Recognize there's a lot in our tradition that will be horrified by a bankruptcy settlement. Not only that, as I mentioned before, Judaism does not have an institution of bankruptcy to help people who can't pay their debts. Sometimes people point to the law of Shemitah, the sabbatical year, as an early example of bankruptcy protection, but it's not. I see Mordechai shaking his head. Why isn't Shemitah? What's the difference between Shemitah and bankruptcy? Mordechai, you're muted. Good. Dr. Silverberg points out it applies to everybody, right? What happens in the sabbatical year, and there's a sabbatical year coming up, God willing, the next Hebrew year, is that all debts that are already overdue are abolished. Unless you take advantage of certain loopholes, all debts are abolished. Well, if all debts are abolished, that's not the same thing as bankruptcy at all. Number one, there's no settlement here. There's no agreement of I'm going to pay X. There's no restructuring. And number two, as Dr. Silverberg said, as Michael said, it applies to everybody. It doesn't matter whether they're wealthy or indigent. This isn't really bankruptcy. Interestingly, though, The modern Hebrew term for bankruptcy goes all the way back to the Talmud. What is the term in Hebrew today for bankruptcy? Anybody know?
Pshitat regel,
right? To be poshet regel. So that term goes back to the Talmud, but it wasn't about somebody who had a bankruptcy. Literally, to be poshet regel means to extend your leg. And in the Talmud, it's talking about somebody refusing to pay. It was a statement of, I'm not going to pay you. You stick out your leg. Apparently, that's a somewhat probably disrespectful gesture. So the truth of the matter is, we didn't classically have bankruptcy. We did have protections for debtors. It's important to note. We had protections on behalf of debtors. So, for example, I mentioned before, you can't force a debtor to work. There's no such thing as debt slavery. And the Talmud says that explicitly. I brought it for you in source number 8, the Talmud in Kiddushin. You can make somebody a slave if he steals and then is not able to repay it. But you can't.
What about Eved Ivri?
Sorry?
What about Eved Ivri?
Eved Ivri is not somebody who had debts and was forced into it. He could choose. A person could choose to become an Eved if he wished. But that's a far cry from being compelled. It's a different story altogether. You can't force it. I gave a class on this back in 2015. If you take a look at source number 9, there's a link to that for more of a discussion. But not only are we not able to force them to go into slavery for it, but we actually have to protect them in interesting ways. In source number 10, I brought you a verse from Exodus, which says, regarding a loan, it says that if you lend money to somebody, lo si yelo kinoshe, don't act to him like you are his creditor, even though you are the person's creditor. And what that means in practice is that you're not allowed to go in front of this person when you know that they owe you the money and you know that they're unable to pay. You're not allowed to walk in front of them, make them feel bad, remind them that they owe you money. That's not acceptable. There are all sorts of rules governing how you claim someone's property for payment of a debt. Canceling a person's debt is considered to be an act of tzedakah. It's considered to be very appropriate as philanthropy. But fundamentally, there's still no bankruptcy discharge. So the bottom line out of that, hang on one second. The bottom line out of what we've said is that the client is right to be upset. We don't have a bankruptcy precedent in Judaism. Michael and then Mark.
You say the operative term there, as you were talking about it, is that the person, the creditor, doesn't have a right, assuming that the debtor actually does not have the ability to pay. This is it's a very tricky problem, you know, number one. And I also wanted to comment that I think that when you were talking about Shemitah, I think a better corollary might be what we have in Canada and in the U.S., which is a statute of limitations. Basically, if you don't get off your rear end and take some sort of constructive action to deal with this outstanding amount that's owed you, after a while, you simply don't have that option anymore. The courts take it away from you. You see, after 2 years of statute of limitations, you can't do anything about it.
But this is not like the statute of limitations, because here, no matter what you're doing, you could be jumping up and down. It doesn't make a difference. The sabbatical year kicks in no matter what you do.
Same with the statute of limitations.
No, but the statute of limitations means if I haven't done anything, if I haven't taken him to court, this rule of Shemitah is no matter what you do. Mark, you were going to say?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Are there other protections for the debtor in that you can't remove from them the ability to make a living? And also if you take from them their bed clothing and stuff like that, you have to return it every night?
Right, so that was all included when I said there are rules governing taking somebody's property for payment of a debt. There are all sorts of limitations on what you can take and when you can take it and when you have to give it back to them. That is certainly very true. But here's the thing. Validating them is a first step, but it's not going to get them to accept filing for bankruptcy. Your next stage is to show them that the concept in Judaism is even stronger than bankruptcy. Because in Judaism, we actually seek outright forgiveness of the debt. It's stronger than bankruptcy. Meaning, one reason we don't have a bankruptcy institution in Judaism is, as we said, the religious duty to repay. Whereas in a secular system, the obligation to pay your debts is a social obligation between one human being and another. So society says we can forgive that. Within Judaism, the obligation to pay your debts is actually a religious obligation. It's between you and God. Those verses that I quoted quickly in the beginning. So it's not for society to forgive it. So the first reason why you don't have a bankruptcy institution in Judaism is because the duty to repay is fundamentally religious. Society can't forgive the fact that God says, I want you to repay. That's number one. Number two, the second reason we don't have an institution of bankruptcy is because Jewish law in general includes an economic policy of encouraging lending by boosting the powers of a lender. Jewish law tries to strengthen the hands of the lender. Remember that lending in Judaism is viewed as a mitzvah of tzedakah. It's considered to be, lending itself is considered to be philanthropic. I brought you a verse in source number 10, not number 10, sorry, that's not the one that I wanted. It is the one that I brought on the sheet, but it's not the one that I wanted. I'm going to skip quoting the verse for now. It's not so relevant for us in any case. It's not the one that I wanted, what I have on there. But there's a verse in Deuteronomy. This is the one I wanted. In chapter 15 of Deuteronomy, which speaks about helping out somebody who is needy, and specifically doing so by lending money. It is a form of tzedakah. The best proof that lending is considered in Judaism a form of tzedakah is the law of ribis, or rebit. What is rebit?
Interest.
The Torah says that when I lend another Jew money, I am not allowed to charge interest, right? We've discussed this, I think, on other occasions. What is the technical financial term for an interest-free loan? There's a technical term for an interest-free loan. Yes. It's called suicide. Right? Interest-free loans fundamentally are suicidal. Because in the best case scenario, the absolute number one best case scenario, you get paid back on time, without a fight, without a fuss, and then you've still lost opportunity cost, and you've still lost inflation. The $10,000 you lent the guy a year ago can't buy what it could have bought then. And in between, the guy said to you, you should invest in this little company, it's called Moderna, right? And you wanted to, but you didn't have money. So you didn't invest in Moderna, and now here you are kicking yourself and saying, it's because I lent this guy the money. I didn't have the money, I lost my opportunity. So that's in the best case scenario. And the worst case scenario, the person doesn't have the means to pay you back. The person fights you in court. You have to go racing after the person. You never end up getting paid back fully. Lending people money and not charging interest is fundamentally damaging to yourself. So why does the Torah demand that you do it? Because lending, as far as the Torah is concerned, is a form of assistance to others. And the result of that is that the Torah wants to encourage people, for reasons that are religious, as well as practical, to lend others money. And therefore, the rabbis structure the rules for lending, as well as claiming repayment, in order to favor the lender. I gave you an example in source number 11 from a passage in the Talmud, but I'm going to explain it outside of the text. The rule is that in order to claim payment from somebody in a rabbinical court, if I need to take somebody to a rabbinical court, I can have any three guys serve as my judges. They don't have to have special training. They don't need to be experts. They can just serve as the judges on the rabbinical court. I can have what are called in the Talmud hedyotos. Not only that, I don't need to go through a full, deep investigation and thorough analysis of the witnesses and their testimony. You hear what they have to say. You certify they were there, and that's it. And the Talmud says in source number 11 that that's not really the way it should be. Letter of the law, in order to hear a case regarding repayment of a debt, you should require expert judges. It should really need experts. And in order to hear a case involving repayment of a debt, you should require a full and thorough investigation of the witnesses. But the rabbi said, if we do that, no one's going to want to lend money anymore. Because they're going to know that if they have an issue with claiming payment of the debt, they're going to have to go after the borrower and get expert judges and get a full analysis, and the witnesses are going to be thrown out. And they say, forget it, I don't need this headache. And the result will be they won't lend money. And therefore, in these cases, as well as in other laws, the rabbis went out of their way to encourage lending, to make things easier for the lender. Is that clear? So that's your second reason why there's no bankruptcy structure, there's no bankruptcy option, because we're trying to bias things to help the lender. You follow? Again, I want to make sure that I'm being clear here. We're getting towards something, but in the steps, it's really important to follow what, you know, step by step here. So far, what we've said is this person is right for feeling that they shouldn't be filing for bankruptcy. There's a basis for it. Judaism doesn't have an institution of bankruptcy. You're supposed to pay the debt. But you have to understand why we don't have an institution of bankruptcy, and I've given two reasons so far. Number one, because God says pay back, and it's not for us to forgive God, what the person's obligation to God. Number two, because we do favor lenders. We want to make sure to support lenders. But there's also a third and the most important reason why we don't have a bankruptcy institution. And this comes back to what I said a little bit earlier, which is Judaism has a stronger approach. We want the creditor to actually forgive the debt altogether. Not a restructuring, not a proposal, but just forgive it altogether. And this is what we call lifnim mishuras hadin, transcending the line of the law, transcending one's legal obligations. Meaning, I'm not obligated to forgive this guy. He owes me money. Nonetheless, I am going to go beyond the letter of the law, and I am going to forgive him. The Talmud in source number 12 deduces from a verse in Exodus that there is actually a biblical obligation to go beyond the letter of the law in your obligations. This is what we call lifnim mishurat hadin. It actually tells a story which I should have brought on the source sheet, but I didn't. I'll tell you the story. There's an obligation in Judaism that if someone is struggling with a burden, you're supposed to help them either load the burden or unload the burden, depending on what it is that they're trying to do. They're struggling to load it, you're supposed to help them load it. They're struggling to unload it, help them to unload it. So the Talmud tells a story of a sage by the name of Rabbi Yishmael, who sees a man struggling under a load of wood. And he knows he should help the guy. But he says, I can't. I can't help him. I'm not physically strong enough. He shouldn't really do it. He's an elder. So what does he do? He buys the wood off the guy. He says, here, I'm going to buy the wood off you. Leave it by the side of the road. Guy leaves the wood by the side of the road. Rabbi Yishmael is now the owner of the wood. He declares the wood ownerless. You follow? He has taken care of his obligation by buying the wood. And then he leaves the wood. So this guy sees the wood there and says, great. He acquires the wood. He picks up some of the wood and says, I am acquiring the wood for myself. Now Rabbi Yishmael has to help me again to load the wood. Rabbi Yishmael, again, buys the wood off of him. So he has now paid for the wood twice. Then the guy wants to again make to grab the wood. And he says, no, I've rendered it ownerless, but not for you. Ownerless for anybody but you. That's the way the story is told. And the Talmud asks, but Rabbi Yishmael is exempt. He's an elder. He has no obligation to this guy. And the answer is, yeah, but he went beyond the letter of the law. Just like the passage in source number 12, he went beyond what he was obligated to do. Go even further with a remarkable story in source number 13. Passage in the Talmud in source number 13. About a sage by the name of Rabbi Bar Bar Hanan who had wine to transport from point A to point B. So porters broke his wine barrels. You had people who were carrying the wine. Porters broke the wine barrels. And he took their cloaks as payment for the wine. He took the cloaks as payment of the wine. So the porters said to Rav, he took our cloaks. Sorry, let me just make sure I'm saying this clearly. Are people following what I'm saying here? Okay.
They went to a third party, to a Beis Din.
Yeah, well, they went to a sage. They didn't go to a Beis Din. They went to a sage. That's actually important in the case. The porters broke his wine barrels. He takes their cloaks. They complain to Rav, one of the sages. Rav says to Rav Bar Bar Hanan, give them their cloaks back. He says, is that the law? And Rav says, yes. And he quotes him a verse from Proverbs that says, so that you will walk the path of the good. Walk the path of the good. Give them back their cloaks. So the porters then said, you know, we're poor. We worked all day long. We're hungry. We have nothing. He didn't pay us. Rav says to Rav Bar Bar Hanan, pay them for their work. They broke your barrels. Pay them for the day's work. He says, seriously? Is that the law? And Rav says, yeah. And he quotes you the rest of the verse in Proverbs, guard the path of the righteous. I want you to do this even though you're exempt. Now, there's a lot of discussion on this case. Is this really an obligation? Is it just a nice thing to do? But what emerges here is there is an expectation that those who are in a position of power will transcend their legal obligation to help out others who are in need. That's the point. You go beyond what you're obligated to do. And I think that's the point for the client who doesn't want to file for bankruptcy. It's true. There is a religious imperative to pay. And it's true. Their parents, Holocaust survivors, would never, ever have wanted to file for bankruptcy. It's correct. However, Judaism expects the creditor to go beyond the letter of the law, to transcend their duty. And filing for bankruptcy is effectively an invitation to the lender to fulfill what God wants of them, to fulfill their religious duty. You're summoning them to go lifnim mishuras hadin, to go beyond the letter of the law. And that's a way that they can look at it that may be more palatable to them. Are we clear about item number one?
What about Dina de Malchusa?
Yeah.
You know, I'm just kind of going back and thinking about the client's concern. Maybe you could tell her that the Dina de Malchusa, I mean, you know, and we Davka hold by that in matters of monetary matters, as I understand.
Right. So Michael points out we have a principle that the law of the land is the law. So why not tell the client, you know, the law of the land is binding, and therefore clearly Judaism will accept this. So the answer is that we'll have to talk about whether that's really true for bankruptcy, whether Dina de Malchuta actually validates bankruptcy or not. But if this works for the client, you know, in other words, if it's true that Dina de Malchusa actually does apply to bankruptcy and it satisfies the client, that's great. I'm thinking the client might say, sure, it's legally valid, but it's still not a good thing to do. I'm trying to show that it's even a good thing to do, which I think is stronger. But we'll see whether Dina de Malchuta works on our next vignette. Other questions and comments related to vignette one before we move on to the second one?
Idea of walking the path of the just and going the flim mishuras adin, the obligation on a creditor. Does this apply to all creditors equally? That there's no distinction between. I mean, it is a mitzvah to do. There are many people who lend money, even though it might be somewhat risky and painful to them. And then the reward they get is good for you. You're going to get a mitzvah. You know.
Oop, lost the rest of Michael there. So I lost the rest of what Michael was saying, but I understood what he was saying. And the answer is it may not apply to all lenders equally. The truth of the matter is, and this is a more complicated subject, that people who naturally engage in more pious and righteous behavior will have a greater obligation to go beyond the expectations of the law. In situations in which there's a greater imbalance between the wealth of the lender and the wealth of the borrower, that increases the imperative to go beyond the letter of the law. So you're right, Michael. Now you're back. I see you. It isn't a simple topic. I didn't put a link there. I was going to, because I had given some classes on this as well. But maybe I'll send it out when I do the follow-up email from the session. I'm going to go to vignette number two, because it's already 8:23. Yeah.
Quick question. Was the point of that scenario about how you frame your message to your Jewish client, or are you suggesting you have a different message for Jewish and non-Jewish clients?
Well, I think it is a different message, because the non-Jewish client doesn't have a religious obligation. Or it's not really about the non-Jewish client, it's the non-Jewish lender. The main reason to frame it in terms of the Jewish client is because I wanted to talk about this subject, and the Law Society specifically will give credit if you're talking about one of the agenda items that they have, and one of them is cultural sensitivity. So it fit. Okay. The second vignette that we asked about is essentially, and you can go back to the original listing, but I'm going to say it here. You have a client who's filing for bankruptcy. It's a member of the Jewish community. How do you protect them from being challenged either in a rabbinical court or just in general from people in the Jewish community? So the truth of the matter is that they're not going to get challenged in a rabbinical court. Why not? A good lawyer should know this. Why won't they get challenged in a rabbinical court? The rabbinical court has no standing. If you take a look at source number 14, the Bankruptcy and Insolvency Act, subject to a whole bunch of subsections and sections, on the filing of a notice of intention under section 50.4 by an insolvent person, no creditor has any remedy against the insolvent person or the insolvent person's property, or shall commence or continue any action, execution, or other proceedings for the recovery of a claim provable in bankruptcy. In other words, if somebody includes a particular debt in a bankruptcy proposal and the proposal is accepted, then they have no recourse. They can't do anything. Somebody could take you to a Beit Din, they could take you to a rabbinical court all they like. However, the rabbinical court's decision, even if they say you have to pay up, you're going to go back and say, we already had this proposal approved, it's over. You have no jurisdiction in this case. Or Michael Broyd showed me several years ago a U.S. case in which it was suggested that maybe the rabbinical court's challenge will count as free expression, and therefore will be exempt from this rule. That's a creative idea, but that argument never made it to court. Okay. But nonetheless, even if they can't challenge in a rabbinical court, there is still the issue of community stigma. What do you do to protect from community stigma? So I want to first show you arguments that do not work in Judaism, and then get to the ones that do. Someone asked a question in the chat, which again I like to avoid, but it's here. If my creditor forgives me because he's gone beyond the letter of the law, does that remove my religious imperative to follow through on my commitments and repay my debts, as brought in source number two? So ostensibly, the answer is yes. They forgave it, and therefore the religious duty is no longer present. Because the debt no longer exists. The only thing that I would note is we have a classic Mishnah which deals with the following questions. The Mishnah at the end of Shviyas. What if you had the sabbatical year come? Shemitah came and went. I owed Michael $10,000. Shemitah came along, got rid of it. So we learn in the Mishnah there that there's still value in me going to Michael and offering to repay. And when Michael says Shemitah got rid of it, for me to say, nonetheless, here's a gift. There is value to that. So I'm not so sure it's entirely erased based on the fact that somebody forgave it. That's, I think, worth noting. Okay. So an argument that does not work to defend bankruptcy is the argument called Yeush. What does Yeush mean? Anybody know?
Despair.
Despair. Good. Sorry, what, Shlomi?
Despair. You gave up.
Despair. Right. Despair. The idea of giving up hope. When people learn Talmud in elementary school, this is usually one of the first passages of Talmud that they learn about. If I'm walking through the marketplace and I find something that somebody dropped there, and it's a big public area and hundreds and thousands of people have walked through there, I can assume that they already gave up hope of ever getting it back unless their name was on it, unless it was left in a particular place, unless. The idea of Yeush, the idea that they have abandoned hope. So maybe the argument could be made. The creditor gave up hope because the borrower lacked funds to repay. However, Rabbi Yosef Kolon, in source number 15, says that does not work. Saying, well, he had no money, therefore the creditor gave up hope, is nonsense. Why? Because every time you lend, it's subject to doubt about whether or not you will be repaid. Sometimes the creditor believes the borrower is actually needy, and it turns out, no, that he has a lot of money. Sometimes you believe he's really powerful and he's refusing to pay, and that's not true. You don't necessarily know all of the facts of the case, and therefore the fact that the creditor says, "Oh no, what am I going to do?" He says he doesn't have any money, does not mean he's actually given up hope of ever getting paid back just because he thinks the person doesn't have means. What about though? Making the argument that the creditor gives up hope because the borrower filed for bankruptcy. So maybe now the creditor gives up hope and that's that. Can you make that argument? So Rabbi Meir Auerbach said no in source number 16. He says any time the borrower does something to cause the lender to abandon hope, that's not effective. Take a look in number 16. He said, in debts, if a person has the means to fulfill his obligation and he doesn't wish to pay, okay, like in the case entertained in source number 15, where he does have the means, he just doesn't want to pay, then the borrower causes the abandonment of hope. The borrower is causing the lender to give up hope. And it's possible to say that that loss of hope is ineffective. It's like theft. The money came to him in a prohibited way, and he compelled the rightful owners to abandon hope. The fact that the borrower says, I'm not going to pay you because I'm getting recourse through the courts, does not work to say, now the lender gave up hope, and therefore he can't claim it anymore. That's not so. What may work is if you get the creditor, this creditor who otherwise is going to be besmirching you in the community, to actively agree. They vote on the bankruptcy agreement, and they vote yes. So maybe that will work. However, the creditor may say, I didn't have a choice. I agreed to it against my will. So that's not a valid agreement in the eyes of Jewish law, and that's what I showed you in source number 17 from the Code of Jewish Law. So things don't look great right now. What we seem to be saying is that the creditor can indeed come after you still in the Jewish community and say what you did isn't right, but not necessarily. Jewish law might recognize bankruptcy under one of two doctrines. First is the one that Michael mentioned before, Dina de Malchuta Dina, the idea that the law of the land is the law, and particularly if one of the parties is not Jewish, but we're dealing with a case in which it's a Jew. The Talmud indeed states, the law of the land is the law, with a variety of reasons for that. Perhaps it's because the government owns the land and the government's able to make the rules. Perhaps it's social contract. There are all sorts of reasons that are given. But the scope of that validation of the law of the land includes laws that are created in order to benefit society as a whole. In other words, let me backtrack for a moment because this does require a little bit more sophistication. It's not straightforward. I mentioned that there are different reasons why we recognize the law of the land. One of the reasons is to say, well, the government owns the land. So if you want to live there, you have to accept their rules. If that's true, if that's why we recognize the law of the land, That may only apply to laws that are made for the good of the government, but not laws that are made for the good of society as a whole. As opposed to, if the reason why we validate the law of the land, the reason why we accept it, is because of social contract, then even laws that the government makes to help the general population will also be valid. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 18, brings the view that says that that law of the land includes that which benefits the king. He's dealing with kings in 16th century Poland, or that which benefits the citizens of the land. Either way. So law of the land will include laws that benefit society as a whole, which will include, apparently, bankruptcy. There's actually a lot of debate, though, about this score. And the reason there's a debate is because not all rabbis agree that bankruptcy is about helping society. I asked the question an hour ago of why we have a bankruptcy institution. So some believe this is meant to help society as a whole for the reasons that we already described. And others say it doesn't meet the standards of helping the citizens. So that the Rabbi Moshe Feinstein in source number 19 says this is a law that benefits society and therefore Jewish law will indeed accept bankruptcy. On the other hand, Rabbi Yaakov Breish, the Chelkas Yaakov, disagrees and says, no, it doesn't meet the standard of something that helps society. Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau in Israel, a judge who passed away about 5 or 6 years ago, also wrote against this. So what we're saying here is this. I feel like I might be losing people because I'm monologuing a lot, and I try to avoid that. But we already said you can't say that the bankruptcy is accepted because the creditor gave up hope because the borrower didn't have money. And we said you can't say that it's valid because the creditor gave up hope just because there was a filing. That doesn't work either. You might be able to say that if the creditor signed on to it, he voted in favor of the proposal, maybe that works. That's subject to some debate. You might be able to argue it under Dina de Malchusa, law of the land, if you accept that bankruptcy is an institution that helps society. But the best argument that I have found to accept bankruptcy, really, is what's called minhag sochrim, basic commercial practice. In Judaism, we accept that when you enter into a commercial agreement with somebody else, any commercial agreement, a sale, a loan, an employment agreement, anything, automatically you agree to follow local custom. That's the way it works. And I think I even brought you on the sheet a statement of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein in source number 22. He's dealing with rent control, in which he says that this is true. That's not what I had wanted. Never mind source number 22. Number 23, I should say. But he makes the statement. I thought I had a different source on there. That's not the source I wanted. In any case, he makes a statement in the same responsum that it even includes practices that are established in the non-Jewish population. Whatever practices become the norm in a particular area of business apply by default to interactions that Jews have. And this may be applied to bankruptcy as well. If this is normal business practice, then it's binding automatically. And therefore, when you go through the procedure, there really is no complaint that anybody else is able to have. So that's a way that bankruptcy will be recognized. One other note within this. Some people in the community may be upset that this person is going to civil court for their bankruptcy instead of going to a rabbinical court. We've talked about this before. The fact that Jewish law really wants Jews to go to a Beit Din, go to a rabbinical court, for a few reasons. Why does Jewish law want Jews to go to a rabbinical court instead of to a secular court, to a civil court? What's the rationale?
Just to keep the argument within the community. I mean, to get it settled in a way that's more respectful and doesn't bring the community into disrepute.
So oddly enough, that isn't one of the reasons that's usually brought. What's the reason why? Someone give me an explanation for why Jewish law wants Jews to go to rabbinical court instead of to a secular court.
They consider it a higher level of justice, maybe?
So that's, well, not that it's considered a higher one, but that by going to a secular court, this is one explanation, you show preference for the secular system. It looks like you don't respect the Jewish system of adjudication. That's one explanation. David, you were going to say?
I was going to say the same thing.
Okay. That's one approach. Rashi, the beginning of Parashas Mishpatim, says that. A second approach is, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet says this, you undermine the continuity of the Jewish system. Meaning, if people don't go to Jewish courts in order to hear these cases, Jewish law itself will atrophy. Because we won't be studying it on a practical level and implementing it on a practical level. And then a third reason I would suggest is because the Talmud frames justice as a religious experience. It's not just, here's my job and this is what I do. It's not just, let's make sure cases are resolved fairly and people are living at peace. But the practice of justice in Judaism is actually a religious act. You are considered a partner with God in creation when you judge a case honestly and fairly. So because of that, don't go outside of the religious system in order to deal with your case. So based on that, somebody might say, don't go to a secular court for bankruptcy. But here in source number 26, I gave you what Professor Reznikoff writes in that article I mentioned in the beginning. Take a look at number 26. He says, a bankruptcy is technically an in rem proceeding. The debtor does not affirmatively sue anyone in court. Instead, the debtor merely appears before the court and seeks its relief. At least where there is no dispute as to the debtor's eligibility for a discharge, the secular court arguably does not adjudicate legal issues between parties. In such case, by filing for bankruptcy relief, the debtor is essentially applying to a government office for a special permit or benefit, not submitting to a court for the resolution of a dispute. Right? You can argue this isn't taking somebody to court at all. This is just, there's a formality. You have to follow this procedure. This is the, you know, this is what you do. It happens to be in a courtroom setting, using a judge. But it's not it's not what the Torah is talking about when it says not to go to secular court. That's a suggestion for dealing with this problem. But a couple of pieces of advice which I've received from Rabbi Asher Meyer and Rabbi Michael Broyd, that the advice that may help to avoid challenge within the Jewish community. Number one, at the origination of any loan, make sure that the agreement includes a clause stipulating which rabbinical court you'll go to if there are disagreements about payment of the loan. And pick a rabbinical court that recognizes a bankruptcy discharge. So just pick your court in the beginning in a way that you're going to get a friendly venue. What if it's too late for that? The loan was already extended. Now what do I do? Then as a condition of the bankruptcy proposal, require the creditor to agree that if the creditor is going to pursue the claim in a rabbinical court, he'll do it with a particular set of judges, rabbinical judges, who recognize the bankruptcy discharge. Either way, what you're trying to do is angle it to make sure you'll have a court, a rabbinical court involved, which does recognize the bankruptcy.
But who's doing this? The borrower?
Well, the borrower and the borrower's lawyer, but yeah.
Lender that drafts any kind of documentation or promissory note or agreement or anything like that.
Right, so but the borrower doesn't sign it without getting whatever they want in it. In other words, I mean, I understand the power dynamic here, right? The lender is the one who has the money. But if the borrower is smart, you know, the borrower is going to say, I need to find a way to be protected or else this could be a problem. And a lender may come back and say, I'm not really interested in lending money to somebody who's planning bankruptcy from the beginning. That may be a red flag.
That's not going to be very encouraging to a lender. You know, listen, before we go on, let's just put something in here about bankruptcy. You know what? I changed my mind. I mean, thank you very much.
Right, but you know, we have prenuptial agreements. You know, people do recognize that things can go wrong. Yeah, the answer may well be that this is necessary, but I understand what you're saying. I hear you.
You were talking for three reasons, Regina, that going through a civil court is discouraged. And I was just thinking that maybe an overarching reason might be the same reason that Moshe Rabbeinu was not happy when the Jews turned to him and said, well, yeah, good idea, let's set up some courts. He didn't want to set up courts. He just wanted to teach them.
Who says that he wasn't happy?
There's, I'm trying to remember, this is when Yisrael made the suggestion that he set up all sorts of levels of
He doesn't. Moshe does not object. I mean, he goes back to God, and God says, go do it, and he does it.
There was something in there about that he preferred that they would just come to him and get the right idea as opposed to winning. In other words, there was some sort of criticism of him.
I don't know. You can come back to me later with it, just because we're running out of time and we have a third vignette to see. I do want to call your attention, because I realize I've spoken really quickly and it's not so simple, a lot of this. I want to call your attention to the end of the source sheet where I gave you 9 review questions. We can already answer a whole bunch of them. Right, we talked about how bankruptcy might benefit society, reducing incentives for criminal behavior, reducing the burden on society to support an eternal debtor, encouraging wise lending, encouraging entrepreneurship with a safety net. 3 biblical sources for the duty to repay debts, the requirement of honest commitments, producing the collateral on demand, and returning property that belongs to others. 2 examples of biblical protection for debtors. We said that there's no debt slavery, and you're not allowed to act as a creditor, to go to the guy for repayment when you know he can't repay you. The 3 reasons why Judaism does not have a bankruptcy procedure. Because there's a duty to repay, meaning a religious duty to repay, and because we want to encourage lending, and because there's a stronger duty of lefnim mishurat hadin, going beyond the letter of the law. Will Jewish law accept bankruptcy as binding by dint of the creditor's agreement? So we said, not if he can argue compulsion. If he can argue that he was compelled, then it may not work, and we don't say that he gave up hope either. What are 2 Jewish legal doctrines which might be invoked to support bankruptcy? So one is that the law of the land is the law, according to those who say that it applies here. And minhag sochrim, that you respect whatever is standard commercial practice. And then the steps one could take to prevent conflict surrounding bankruptcy were those 2 ideas. At the origination of the loan, stipulating the court, the rabbinical court, or as part of the bankruptcy proposal. I want to get to our third vignette. And our third vignette was the COVID question. The observant Jewish client owns a Jewish summer camp. They're not able to run over the summer because of COVID, but they spent all the money that people gave them in deposits on physical infrastructure and administrative salaries. Would they be better off addressing this in a secular court or a rabbinical court? So we already said that we really want them to go to a rabbinical court in general. But where will you get a better decision? So actually probably rabbinical court. Secular, it depends a little bit on how you structure your contracts. Secular court will say one of 2 things. Either if your contract has within it a force majeure clause, right? A clause that says when something big happens, an act of God that prevents you from delivering the service, then this is what you do. If you have a force majeure clause, then that's going to dictate, as long as the clause actually includes whatever happens. So in other words, if the clause said public health emergency or pandemic, then as far as the court is going to be concerned, that's what holds sway. In source number 27, we have somebody here from Dickinson Wright. So this is your firm that I pulled this from. The force majeure clauses authorize contracting parties to extend or suspend the time of performance, to be excused from performance in whole or in part, .. And you can see the whole description there in source number 27. So if you have such a clause, and it fits the circumstances, it will dictate what you do. What happens if you don't have a force majeure clause? Then what happens? Does that just mean that the customers get their money back? What happens in a civil setting, common law, whatever you want to, what would you do?
Well,
Our case, the summer camp case, comes to court. What does the judge say?
There's a lot about frustration.
Yeah. Frustration of contract, exactly. Alan, is that what you were going to say?
No.
Oh, go ahead, Alan.
No, just a force majeure just gives you an excuse or an exemption if the force majeure occurs.
Mm-hmm.
If the force majeure doesn't occur, then you're not excused legally from performance. Frustration is, though, a concept that I think the, and this will be litigated now because of COVID for years, but I think the classic thought is that COVID is not necessarily frustration of a contract.
So that really depends, I mean, based on what I've read. Let me go step by step here. The frustration of contract in general is what I put in source number 28. The Frustrated Contracts Act. This act applies to any contract that is governed by the law of Ontario and that has become impossible of performance or been otherwise frustrated, and to the parties which for that reason have been discharged. The statement here in source number 28, and Michael, I see a note in the chat about Michael's point about the Moshe being unhappy. If I have time at the end, I'll come back to it. But the Frustrated Contracts Act says, if you absolutely cannot fulfill the contract anymore, then what happens is full refund of all payments, unless the business already incurred costs, or unless the client already received partial benefit, in which case the court will evaluate the benefit that's been received or the costs that have been paid and decide how much goes back to the customer. What Alan is pointing out, the question of whether COVID qualifies or not, depends on a few factors. Number one, if the business says we're able to fulfill it, just wait 6 months or wait a year, does that really constitute frustration of contract? Or in a case that I saw from, I think it was either Alberta or BC, there was a woman who hired entertainers for her wedding and envisioned 1,500 people. Then the province said you can only have 25. So she wanted to argue frustration of contract. They're not going to be able to fulfill it to perform at a wedding of 1,500 people. So therefore, I don't have to pay them. And the court said that's not true. The court said you still have to pay them because they can perform. It's just a wedding of 25 people, or they had offered to delay and do the wedding later on. So the court said that's not frustration of contract. But fundamentally, within civil law, either you have a force majeure clause, which stipulates what to do and in what circumstances you do it, or the argument is frustration of contract, and if you can prove that it's actually frustration of contract, the contract cannot be fulfilled as it was originally constituted, then the business may be able to claim the costs that they spent. They may be able to claim they gave you partial benefit already, if that's true. And then the rest of it they'll have to refund to the customer. What will happen in rabbinical court? So rabbinical court recognizes force majeure clauses. As a matter of fact, some rabbis actually write that they're taken automatically, that it's a given, which doesn't quite map to force majeure because you're supposed to stipulate what happens, and that's not going to occur if this wasn't actually written out. Nonetheless, we recognize force majeure. We also recognize frustration of contract in Jewish law, meaning if somebody said, I'm going to provide X service, and then they can't provide it, they didn't do the service. So, ostensibly, the money should then go back to the customer. However, where the reason for frustration is called makat medina, meaning something that didn't just frustrate this contract, but it frustrated everybody's contracts, then we might actually favor the business. Okay? In other words, let me make sure that I'm saying this clearly because I'm rushing a little bit and that's always dangerous. Normally, we would say, we recognize frustration of contract and we would say, therefore, that the customer is entitled to a refund. However, if the reason why the contract was frustrated was something that frustrates everybody's contracts, then we might say no, there's no refund. There's a classic case in this regard that I brought you in source number 29. Somebody rents a field. He's going to work the field for the year, he's going to keep the produce, and he's going to pay a certain amount to the owner of the field. He's a tenant farmer. The field gets eaten by locusts or damaged by plague. If it's what we call makat medina, it affects everybody, then he's allowed to reduce his rental payment. He can say, I'm not paying you for everything. If it's not a makat medina, then he's not able to reduce his rental payment. So the tenant farmer, essentially we ask, was what happened local to you? If what happened was local to you, you're out of luck. But if it hit everybody, then not so fast. How does that translate when I hire somebody for a job? So there's a classic case regarding a teacher, which I brought you in source number 30 from Rabbi Moshe Isserles in the Code of Jewish Law. Case was that somebody was a teacher of Judaism at a time when the government decreed that Jews were not allowed to study Torah. He was already hired. He's been paid. What happens now with the money? So the ruling brought in source number 30 from Rabbi Moshe Isserles is, since this was a ban on everybody studying Torah, it's not just about this teacher, the loss is upon the employer. In other words, the employer has to pay. If all contracts are frustrated, you still need to pay. That's what Rabbi Moshe Isserles said. The Sma, a classic commentary on the Code of Jewish Law, Rabbi Yehoshua Falk, says, what are you talking about? He didn't do the job. Why in the world should I pay him if he didn't do the job? I hired him to teach. He's not teaching. So Rabbi Usher Weiss offers suggestions in this regard in source number 31. Rabbi Usher Weiss, a contemporary writer, explains. His first explanation is not really one I want to go into right now because it really requires a full discussion that we don't have time for. I wanted to focus on his second explanation. He says Jewish law always favors the worker. The Torah favors workers, employees, with extra rights. You know, there's a demand that you have to pay the worker on the same day. The worker in the field is allowed to eat the produce from the field. There are all sorts of ways in which Jewish law favors the worker. So too here, in this case, in the event that it's frustration of contract and it's just this guy, you can say, well, somehow or other, this is his fault. It's on him. However, if everybody's contracts are frustrated, you can't make that argument anymore. There's no reason to assume that it's just him. And therefore, he regains the upper hand. So that, what we're really saying is, that in the case of the summer camp, assuming there's no force majeure clause, and assuming this hit all the summer camps, all of them were closed, the answer of a rabbinical court may be to support Rabbi Moshe Isserles and to say, the customer has to pay, even though they didn't get the service. Now, I should note, because this is subject to debate, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, also known as the Chasam Sofer, says we do pshara, we do a compromise. We will split it. And maybe that will help the camp, but maybe it will also help the customer. It's not, we're gonna end up splitting it. My point here is to show you that within Jewish law, it may actually favor the camp, your client, more than the customer, at least before we come to some level of compromise. So, in question number 8 among the review questions, what are the two ways a secular court could resolve a COVID-related cancellation, either force majeure or frustration of contract? And in a rabbinical court, would a service provider who couldn't fulfill the contract due to COVID still be paid? And the answer is Rabbi Moshe Isserles thinks so, although in practice, a rabbinical court is more likely to order compromise than to actually do that. That's the idea. And there's more to be said on this. I wanted to get in something COVID related, but I waited probably a little too long to actually do it. I realize in general, I rushed a lot of things here. I hope that this was somewhat clear. Again, if you didn't sign in, please make sure to sign in the chat now. I see a question in the chat. With respect to relying on the principles of the law of the land, what right do the rabbis have to substitute their, whoops, this is why I hate the chat also, scrolling is hard. What right do the rabbis have to substitute their business sense or their macroeconomic view of the benefits and problems of promoting bankruptcy legislation in society for the government sense? In other words, once the government decides it's in the benefit of society, whether because it promotes business, lending, or it's the government's belief of what a just society ought to look like, so long as it's not based on idolatry, that should be the end of the story. So that's an interesting question. The idea of requiring that it satisfy society, or that it be for the sake of society, is a Jewish law requirement. In other words, recognizing the law of the land is not as simple as saying, the government says it's the law, I guess that means it is the law. It has to present, according to this interpretation of Dina de Malchuta, it has to present some kind of benefit for society as a whole. Governments implement laws all the time that do not exist for the benefit of society. They exist for some other reason. The government may decide that there's a particular lobby that benefits from something, right? This argument comes up. I quoted some response on the sheet about it regarding rent control and the question of whether rent control is actually for the benefit of society, or is it specifically for the benefit of the tenants' associations that get people elected, and they're the ones who are supporting it. So the fact that government implements something doesn't mean that it's actually for the benefit of society. The rabbis are asking the question, does it really benefit society, and trying to come up with an understanding of it.
Does it matter if the government believes it's for the benefit of society, like if you would look at the parliamentary debates?
Yeah, no, that will absolutely come into consideration. This is not a calculation in a vacuum of, I, Rabbi X, believe that this benefits society or don't, or does not. We do look at why they're doing it. Both what they say and what goes on behind the scenes, because to be fair, what is said is not necessarily what's actually felt. But yes, no, the reasons why the government does it matter a great deal, I think. Paul asks a question, is it still suicidal if someone lends money to their kids without charging interest? So I think not. The argument could be that having kids, but that's another discussion. I think you're supposed to support your children. That's a good idea. Okay, so I apologize for elements of this being rushed, and I think I could have done a better job with the source sheet. But nonetheless, I hope that this was somewhat clear. And we have another session coming up in December. Those who are still looking to get their credits, or those who just want to learn Torah, coming up on Sunday morning, December 13th at 9:30 a.m. And I believe our topic is supporting the emotionally needy client, or something along those lines. That isn't quite what I had as the title, but it's something like that. So hopefully you'll...
I think it's the unstable client.
Emotionally unstable client. Thank you. That makes more sense. Supporting the emotionally unstable client.
Bankruptcy is now unstable.
Yeah. All right. So we'll talk about that, God willing, next month.
Thank you.
Shkarach to everybody here.
All right. Thank you very much.
Be well.